Mantras, sound vibrations that harness the subtle energies of creation. When used in a proper way, these sounds create and support profound and positive changes in our own physiology, as well as those around us and in the environment beyond. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. I am your host, Dylan Smith. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and holistic health educator, and also someone that daily picks up my beads that is made of pearls and chants mantras with them. By counting, I invoke certain vibratory sounds that resonate with natural law, and I direct certain mantras to activate certain specific laws of nature. And that's what we're here to talk about today. And what a wonderful man that we're talking with, Swamiji, or Swami Purna Chaitanya as his full name, who was born and brought up in the Netherlands. From a young age, he had a keen interest in the spiritual practices, cultures, and philosophies of the East. And then as a teenager, Swami Purna Chaitanya met his spiritual master, Gurudev Sri Sri Ravi Shankarji. And that's when he started his journey to explore traditions of yoga, meditation, mantras, and ancient wisdom. A life dedicated to purity of knowledge, practice, and experience, sharing his master's wisdom through the programs of the Art of Living, Swami Purna Chaitanya has become a public figure, traveling the world extensively, conducting a wide range of self-development programs in over 20 countries. His relevance stems from his ability to bridge the philosophies of the East and the West and his skill in simplifying arcane concepts. He plays the role of spiritual guide, peace builder, storyteller, author, healer, and teacher, and he triggers dramatic change in the lives of his audience. Swamiji is a beautiful man, as I'm sure you'll experience from listening to this episode. You can check out his website, swamipurnachaitanya.com, and it is amazing, the stuff on there. He's got an awesome blog. He's got free ebooks on mantras. He's got mantras to listen to. He's on Spotify, where you can listen to amazing mantras, one being Dhanvantri Mantra, which is the health aspect of consciousness, also known as the Lord of Ayurveda. So at Vital Veda, for those who are new, this is a podcast where we interview experts in the fields of health consciousness and spirituality, and the Veda, which are the laws of nature. And me being an Ayurvedic practitioner with a focus on health, there's so many other ways to interact with this Veda. Sthapatya Veda, Vedic architecture, Vedic astrology, meditation, yoga, the Vedic knowledge of sound, Gandharva Veda, which we talk a lot about today in this episode about mantras. And also we talk about a lot about Swamiji's life. He's a unique life, being the first non-Indian and the first, especially the first white person to be initiated into the Swami order by his guru, his teacher, Sri Sri Ravi Shankarji. And we go into what that means, initiated into the Swami order. It's a very unique, uncommon way of going in towards an evolutionary path of life, to a spiritual path. Usually it's the householder way. It's the most common here. He's taking a different route and he's been under the guidance to do that. And so this is some of the things we talk about, all the different stages of life, and there's a lot of good stuff. So if you enjoy this podcast, please share it. Take a screenshot on your Instagram and tell us what you think. Leave a comment on the Instagram post associated with this. Tag Vital Veda and tag Swami Purna Chaitanya. And we'd love to hear what you think. Leave a review if you're on iTunes. All this supports the show, and really, like, this support is how we get good guests. I'm so blessed to have a very intricate and articulate teacher like Swami Purna Chaitanya teach about the Vedas. So hope you enjoy this show. Okay, Jai Gurudev Swamiji, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a true pleasure, Dylan.
In my tradition, and a few of these interviews on the Vital Veda podcast, we greet and even say goodbye with this saying, Jai Gurudev. And I would love to hear your interpretation of what it means to you. I believe, I haven't heard you say it yet in this conversation as we've been talking, but I believe in your tradition it is a common words to and sounds that are invoked and exchanged when greeting people. So I'd love to hear your interpretation on what that is for
yes.
you.
So to you and all the listeners, Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev.
To me, this is something also very personal, because my spiritual master, my teacher, Gurudev Sri Sri Ravi Shankarji, has, I would say, carried forward this greeting, I think, from his time also that he spent with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and the tradition of masters that we also belong to. Of course, it's in some ways a very common greeting in India, in a way, because the concept of Gurudev is much more common and maybe even to some extent even more valued. I know that in earlier times, they have a word, it's anath, which means literally in Sanskrit means one who is without a master or without a lord, to translate it literally. And it's interesting that nowadays in India, in Hindi, in the Hindi language, the same word that has come from Sanskrit, of course, is used for orphans. So they say when a child doesn't have their parents anymore, they are called anath. But in ancient times, you can say it wasn't so much one who is without a parent or without their parents, but one who doesn't have a spiritual guide or a spiritual master. Because they said without that, it's really difficult to really progress on the spiritual path, which here I would say is not just maybe doing some yoga or meditation, but that journey of really finding the purpose of your life, of why you are here, which in turn will lead you to that true fulfillment. Because, you know, whether people like it or not, I think everybody is looking for that. In the end, you want to feel happy, you want to feel fulfilled, you want to feel you have a purpose, or to have that real peace of mind. And to figure that out is not so easy, as people continue to demonstrate over the centuries. So they said, yes, if you have found someone who has achieved that truly, and who is also able to communicate that, that one was called a guru, a spiritual teacher. And they say without that, it's quite difficult to reach that goal within the limited span of our human life. And my master has also, he uses the same greeting. It's there in various traditions, of course. And what it means on one level is guru is the guru, the master. And Gurudev is a respectful way of addressing the master. Deva literally means, again, it's a little tricky to translate literally, but you can say that godly aspect also, that sublime aspect, or one who is so radiant, who is so bright, who is so full of light and knowledge. And at the same time, is very playful. So the devatas in the ancient stories of the scriptures also, of course, they're, you can call them angels or gods or aspects of divinity. But there's a lot of playfulness there also. And then Jay means victory. So it's a, I would say, a respectful wish that may that aspect of whether it is your master that you're addressing directly or even each other, like we greet each other. So in us also, there is an aspect of knowledge, the aspect that is full of wisdom, that is eternal, that is very playful. And you can call it maybe the big mind or our... Yeah, but that is not limited, that is not very time-bound or with all its limitations. So in that way, in our tradition also, we love to use this greeting because it's also a kind of wish or blessing or encouragement that in you may that part of you, which is full of knowledge, which is full of light, which has that feeling of connection with the world around and looks at it from that bigger perspective, may that part of you or your consciousness be victorious over maybe the small mind, which tends to have its own little insecurities, fears, you know, and we come to all these distortions of jealousy, greed, and what all not. So Jay means victory. So may that be victorious. I think it's a very beautiful and meaningful way to greet each other than maybe just saying, you know, good day, or of course it's nice if your day is good, but definitely when the part of you that is wise, that is unattached and that cares for everybody is victorious, then I'm sure your day will be good.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's, for me, it's also a constant reminder of that Deva, that celestial being, and an acknowledgement that I am not the innovator of this knowledge, and also of the acknowledgement of the guru, of those higher intelligence that have come before us and that is within us.
Yes.
Beautiful. Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev.
Another thing I'd like to ask, which I like to do with guests who have a Sanskrit name, and particularly those who have got that as their second name, or that they weren't perhaps born with it. I think it's a beautiful way to understand about you personally, because Sanskrit is that sound of nature. So it's the sound that nature's intending to explain or convey. And I'd love to hear about your name, Swami Purna Chaitanya, what it means, how did you get it? And I assume it wasn't your birth name.
No.
Being from the Netherlands.
No. My birth name was, I had a few. The main one I used was Alexander. But okay. When I was 16, I met my teacher, my guru, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, for the first time in Amsterdam, out of all places. He was there for a public discourse. He was visiting the country for 1 or 2 days. And there was a big hall in Amsterdam where he gave a lecture on spirituality and human values. And even at that age, I was already drawn towards the Eastern traditions. My mother has some Indian origins. She's half Indian. But she grew up in the Netherlands, so our upbringing was very Dutch in many ways. But then my parents, during their high school, during their university studies, discovered meditation, did a meditation course, became vegetarian, which was still quite unique in those days. And they started meditating quite regularly. So when I was born, my brother was born, we saw a little bit of that here and there. Not that it was very much part of our life, but it creates a kind of curiosity and also brings it much closer to home. So as I grew up, you see a Buddha statue somewhere, you learn a little bit about the Eastern traditions, see a documentary about Shaolin monks. And I used to do different martial arts, so that pool was there. But then I wanted to go a little deeper, and I was not sure where to look. I read a few books, looking for an authentic path, you can say, or a real teacher. And then when I heard that a spiritual master from India is coming to give a discourse, my mom got to know about it. She told us, he said, oh yes, we would like to come also. And what I remember is that when I walked into that hall, there was a beautiful stage. About maybe 1,000 chairs or so were placed for people to sit on. We were quite early. And then on the stage, there was a sofa, a few flowers around, and a gentleman in white robes with a long beard, long dark hair. He was doing some final preparations, but then he didn't look like the guy from the poster. So I asked one of the volunteers that, this doesn't look like Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, so who is this? And I said, this is one of his disciples, one of his students who is learning from him, who travels with him. And that moment in me, something happened where I felt, that this is still possible in today's world, because that seemed like something from ancient times. And to see that this idea of having a master and then being like a disciple, of course, even in Europe and other parts, we used to have this practice even to learn a trade. You find a master and you learn from them, and then at some point you graduate and you can start your work. But I thought that is from a past long gone. And for me, it was a magical thing in some way, quite mystical, that, in India, this still happens. But then it also felt like, I missed out on that. If I would have been born in India, maybe I could have lived my life like that. And who knew that many years down the line after I met him, I got really inspired. I did some programs that his organization, The Art of Living, offers. Then I wanted to go deeper. And I, at some point, came to India after my university studies. I had already studied Indology, so I had learned some Sanskrit. I had a chance to go a little deeper into the Indian history and traditions, but it wasn't enough for me. I wanted to learn how to chant mantras. I wanted to really go deeper into this knowledge, which you can't really do in university, I found out. So then I spoke to my master. He gave me his blessings, his permission to come to work there as a volunteer, contribute in the ashram, but also at the same time go a little deeper into the Vedic knowledge, learn some of the mantras, the pujas. And after being there for 2-3 years, I felt that this is so fulfilling that I didn't feel like going back to the Netherlands to just do a job and then, pay my bills with that, and maybe have some time in the weekend to really follow what my heart would love to do. Because even when I was young, I was keen to do something that could contribute, that I can help people do something good for the world. And a few years down the line, I continued staying there, learning more things, taking more responsibility. There came a point where my master gave me the opportunity to be initiated as one of his swamis. One of his swamis is a monk of the Vedic tradition. So one who's dedicated his life to serve, to make the world better. And at the same time, that commitment to your personal spiritual journey of self-realization. So there is a beautiful Sanskrit line that says, Atma mokshartam jagat hitaya cha. So these are the two aspects of a sannyasi, you can say. One who has, well, renounced the world sounds a little ominous, but who has dedicated their life to serve, where you say, I no longer worry much about myself. I don't have to live for myself. I live for the good of the world, do my best to help people make the world better, and at the same time, that striving for self-realization. And he gave me that opportunity. It was a little bit of a surprise for me because I didn't know that that was a possibility. He had that till then only initiated a few swamis. They were all Indian. They were a little bit older also. So I never thought that was a possibility for me. But I was and still am very grateful. And then it is a custom to also receive a new name because they say you no longer live for yourself now. So the master gives a new name. So Swami is actually not it's a title. It's not really part of the name. But then Purna Chaitanya is the name that he gave me. And Purna means that which is complete, which is full. And Chaitanya means consciousness. So you can say one whose consciousness has the quality of fullness or that is fully blossomed, which is, of course, a very beautiful name. Now, sometimes people ask me, oh, does that mean you feel that your consciousness has fully blossomed? Well, I really cannot say that, of course. But it's a beautiful tradition where the master gives a name that, yeah, in some way resonates with the flavor of your consciousness. And at the same time, it's kind of intention or blessing also. But yeah, I feel it's a beautiful practice. And at the same time, I've realized that because our name is such a strong or deep impression, it's very deep rooted, that when that changes, in a subtle way, also some things change. Because even before that, I was living a similar lifestyle. I was living out of a suitcase, you know, very simple, would travel. So activity-wise, nothing much changed. But I realized when I started identifying more with this new name that it's almost like you have a clean sheet, like a blank page. Because even if you see in a room, 10 people may be sleeping. But if I call out your name, you may be the only one waking up. So even in that deep sleep state, it's such a strong impression that your consciousness still is connected to that. And I realized that as I started identifying more and more with the new name and using the old one less, identifying with it less, that also a lot of maybe some of these old impressions and patterns, yeah, they just drop off. So that was an interesting realization.
It's also like a mantra. I mean, it is Sanskrit, yes. The sound of nature. So it's encouraging you to awaken to that fullness of consciousness.
Yes.
What age were you when you were initiated into this Swami way of living?
I was, I have to tell you correctly, I believe I was 27. It was in 2012, okay, so 10 years ago.
Okay. So you've mentioned the sannyasi way of life, and there's kind of two general pathways of, I guess, evolution. One is the sannyasi, you said renounce, which sounds intense, yeah. But I love how you put it. It's a selfless in order to serve others. And then there is the householder,
yes,
what we call the grihasthi. And the way that you initiated into this Swami way of living, does that mean, is it very clear that you should not go into a householder way of life, i.e. you should not have relationships, or is that not as, I guess, recommended in your tradition? Because it's interesting. We actually asked on Instagram, usually we ask if people have questions,
yes,
for our guests, and we had a few people asking about brahmacharya, which is related to this sannyasi, this swami way of living. So I just, yeah, curious in your tradition and in your particularly personal life, how much is that involved, this renouncing of relationships in order to serve others? And when I say relationships, I mean intimate, romantic relationships.
Yes. So in the Vedic tradition, of course, we have the four stages of life, you know, the different ashramas. And they say, okay, as a child, first you have your education time, and that is the brahmacharya, because they say also to really focus on your studies and to channelize and fully utilize that energy, it's better not to start too early frolicking around. So they said, you know, traditionally the idea was, of course, it may not have happened in all cases, but that first you finish your education and then you get to those things. So then you start working, you marry, you have a relationship, a family, all of that. And then traditionally they kind of say that there are four stages of life are also, you can divide your life in these four parts. So they say, okay, roughly the first maybe 20, 25 years, you focus on those studies and you learn how to become an individual that can really contribute to society. You have all your values, your skills, your knowledge. Then the next 20, 25 years, you focus on contributing to the society where you start a family, you raise your children, you earn money, you are part of the worldly life, you can say. And then the third part is where you do some seva. They say, okay, when your responsibilities are complete, where your children have grown up and now moved on to be contributing members to society, you can take a step back and then share your experience with people. So you can guide them, you can teach them, you do seva service, you contribute to society in a more selfless manner, you can say. And then they say the last part of your life, sannyas, is where you've even completed that part of your, you can say, obligations or contribution. And then you can move away from all of the worldly things, from society, and really focus on your self-realization and prepare yourself for the onward journey. But they also say that in some cases you can skip one or two of these phases, which are not necessary or even recommended for everyone, but it's allowed, you can say. So there are some cases where someone may continue to live as a brahmachari for the rest of their life, or they may move directly from the stage of being a brahmachari to a sannyasi. So in our tradition, which is part of the Vedic tradition, there is indeed room for all of these. And if you look at my master also, most of his disciples, his students, our volunteers and people all over the world, you know, they have their families, their work. They take out some time in between to serve, to contribute something. And they benefit from the wisdom, from the knowledge and the practices. And there's a few odd ones out, like me, who feel that strong urge to live a life which is fully dedicated to service, where you say, I feel so complete that I don't need much for myself. I'm very content. And who also have completed their responsibilities. Because sometimes people are ready to throw away everything, but that doesn't necessarily mean that their family is okay with it. You know, you may feel that I don't want to take care of my parents, but if they have nobody else to take care of them, we need to take care of them. You know, that is also a responsibility. So in my case, both myself and my master felt that, okay, I'm apparently ready to take this step. So he gave his blessings for that. But yes, then that means as a Swami, as a sannyasi, that it is a lifelong commitment. So yes, it's a path of, like, celibacy is a part of that. So where you no longer would explore or engage in any romantic relationships, it is not a possibility to say, okay, now, you know, okay, let me, this was fun for some time, but now I want to get married, have a family, or just, you know, whatever, do what all I want to do. And in that way, even if you see traditionally, this is also a sanskara. So there are different, of course, you can say transition points in life. I'm sure many of your listeners may be aware with it, but for those who are not, where you say, okay, you move from one phase into another, there is a change or transition that happens. And when that is done in the right manner, it can really help you progress faster towards the goal. So they say a sanskara is basically something that increases the sadhak tattva, the things that support you on your journey to self-realization, because that is the goal in the end. And the badak tattva, that things that can be an obstacle, can be reduced or removed. And like that, there are 16 major ones in a person's life, where some are optional. But it includes like the naming, like you said, a name is also a deep impression. And if it is a mantra, if it is a sound that is very conducive to your evolution, then just hearing that sound and saying it so many times itself will help you to progress faster. In the same way, if someone is given a name like maybe Hitler, which unfortunately sometimes you still come across, like people with all good intention think, oh, he was a great person, but then that association with the name on a subtle or subconscious level also will have an impact on the person. Even if a person himself doesn't have any issue with it, others will look at that person in a certain way. You know, whether they like it or not, it will affect their interactions, the way the world looks at them. So our name is important. So like that, there are different steps. And one of them is marriage, which is optional because they say you don't have to go through it. But sannyas is also in that way a sanskara. It's a transition point in life. And in some ways, if you look also at the mantras that are chanted or usually that are part of the ceremony and the way it is viewed in the whole approach to life and your role in society, is that it's almost like your own cremation or your own final rites. And again, that doesn't mean it's very scary or ominous, but in a way, it's a completion of your duties as a personal individual within the sphere of your family and society. So after that, you are exempted of the duties another member of society may have, where you say, okay, your uncle's children are, someone is getting married, so normally you may have to be there, or one of your parents has passed and you are the one who's supposed to do the final rites. Now you are no longer required to, and it even means that someone else will then take your place. So it exempts you from some of the customary obligations and duties. But at the same time, that means that ritually, for some of these purposes, you are dead. You are no more there. So then if you would want to do a traditional Vedic wedding ceremony, you cannot, because you can't marry someone to a dead person. So ritually, I mean, again, it sounds quite scary, but it's just to understand the significance.
That's fascinating.
Of course, sometimes people may at some point, come to a point in history, it has happened, and even in modern days, where with all good intentions, someone may have taken up this path, and then they come to a point where they realize, oh, you know, I cannot do it, or who knows, they really go head over heels and are not able to stick to their discipline. Because, of course, all kinds of feelings may come up. But some of it is literally, I'm disciplined, so I'm not going to give in to a certain thought or feeling. But sometimes the karma is so strong that it's really difficult. But then, yeah, it is. It's not something that is generally... accepted, again, is a very strong word, but it's not really what you're supposed to do. So it is a commitment. Yeah. Where you say, yes, I live for others.
It's super fascinating. I love how you talked about that aspects of yourself is like dead. It's as if you've surrendered this other path in order for this other path, which is for your personal case.
Exactly. So it's an offering. So they say, I offer all these aspects of myself. And I think that is why personally also I feel very grateful that I have a living master who I feel and I have seen has that capacity to see the bigger picture, and in that way also know that I am really ready for it, because I may feel I am, but sometimes we really don't know what will happen in the future. And there are of course many traditions, but the moment it becomes a tradition, then it depends who is the one who's taking the call. And sometimes it becomes usually it becomes a standard structure. You say, okay, for 8 years, for example, or for 12 years, or you live like a brahmachari. And then after that, you can be initiated as a sannyasi. And you can follow the curriculum. But then there may always be this little small margin of possibility that, okay, but how do you know you're really ready? And I think if you look at other traditions also, like for example, in the Christian tradition, you know, there also there is the concept of being a monk, of being celibate. It is a prerequisite for certain roles. But then we've seen also, of course, in recent years that sometimes people then really struggle. So they say, okay, you have to be celibate to take up that office. But then if that's something that somehow inside you may not be really ready for or not sufficiently prepared, it becomes very difficult for the person. So I think it's very beautiful that there is this concept that you need to be initiated by one who is living that, who's so that he also has the experience. He knows maybe some of the obstacles, he can guide you in that, and he may be able to say, okay, you know, maybe you're not yet ready, or let's see for some more time.
It makes life easier for us. We exactly. don't have to decide.
Exactly.
And we're not at the level to decide. And we may think we want to. I see it the same in my initiations into Ayurvedic different stages of being a physician. And like Krishnanji, I call him my yeah. guru, my doctor. I want to do this. You will, but not yet, you know, or
yeah.
do this now. So it's great. Like as much as sometimes my intellectual mind wanting to do something gets involved. Yeah.
It's like kids, no? Kids, they say, oh, you know, can I also drive? And then the dad says, okay, you know, maybe when you're a little older, or can I have that knife? Can I? No, okay, you know, maybe after yeah. a few years.
Yeah. yeah. For those listening, we did an episode with a woman who was, I believe, also initiated into this brahmacharya or sannyasi way of living at 27 years old also, but as a woman, her name's Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati. And that's episode 83, Hollywood to the Himalayas, Deeper Connections and Euphoric Love. So check that out because we talk about her story and that's interesting. You may know her from Rishikesh. She's well known from Paramahansa Nikitan Ashram.
Yes, I've met her once, yes.
Yes, yes. So I have one more question about your personal self before we get into some other knowledge, because this is actually usually the first question that I ask every guest. But, you know, we had to greet each other with Jay Gurudev and hear about your name. But the question is, Swamiji, what did you do this morning? What was your dinacharya? As you know, in Ayurveda, daily routine is an important thing. And we like to ask our guests this, and feel free to share in whatever detail as you like.
Okay. So I woke up early. I mean, early is relative. For some people, even 7 o'clock is early. But I woke up before 6, took a bath, brushed my teeth, you know, all of those things. Then drank some water. And along with that, right now I had one or two Ayurvedic tablets that my Vaidya prescribed currently to balance my system a little more. So that went, otherwise it would just be some water, but those as well. And then I have a morning routine where I chant some mantras. Some of them also I've been initiated, including Gayatri Mantra. I'll not go into all the details because scriptures also say that certain aspects of your sadhana should be kept secret. Because anyway, people, it's you know, it's something for you, whether people may have all kinds of concepts or you may feel like showing off. So, but I have a few mantras that I chant every day. I do the japa. And then I have a morning routine of some yoga asanas that I do, followed by some pranayama, some breathing techniques, and meditation. And then after that, today, I went straight to my, I got one urgent call, some work-related thing to sort out. I quickly did that. And then I got onto my laptop to see you because, of course, we have a time difference. And this was the right time to make it work. But that was my morning routine so far. And usually this is the first part. And then after that, normally comes breakfast. And then I start my activities.
Beautiful. So you mentioned japa. I'd love to talk about this. It's perhaps seems to me, and many perhaps, that it's one of the paths or practice, or you would call it a type of meditation maybe, or you did just mention now that you distinguish that between that and your meditation, which you did towards the end of your morning routine. But I'd love to learn about japa, particularly coming from a tradition of learning meditation where the mantra is meaningless, it doesn't have a meaning, and it's just designed to make the mind transcend. It's more just a sound, and it's quite different to japa, and japa is something I've developed later, but I can talk about my experience another time. But yeah, perhaps starting like what is japa to explain? I'm sure people will recognize a visual of it when they see that.
Yes. So japa is the repetition of a mantra. And the interesting thing is that even the word mantra itself in the scriptures is defined as mananat trayati iti mantra, which means a mantra is that sound or vibration that can take us beyond the mind, that can save us from the repetitive thoughts in the mind. And the beauty is that in japa, we actually use the same principle, but where we use the positive vibration. So normally when you say, why is repetitive thinking or why are the thoughts a problem? Well, if you think, for example, when you're worrying or when you're angry or upset, you will find that actually what is happening is the same thought keeps coming back again and again, and it pulls your energy down. So that thought, those few words, they carry a meaning, a vibration, and it is pulling your energy down. And when our energy or prana goes down, that is when, you know, we feel more lethargic. A small thing has to happen and you get upset or angry or you become insecure. I'm sure most people can relate to this. You know, those days you feel tired or your energy is really low. It just needs a small thing for you to go out of balance or to lose your centeredness. Or you're less productive, you know, you're less present. While when our energy is high, when you have a lot of prana and the sattva is predominant, then your to-do list is finished much faster. You are more present. You can enjoy things more. The same thing that may normally, I mean, otherwise may seem as a big problem, you just take it as a challenge. Okay, let's see how we can sort this out. So in mantra, usually it is used in the form of japa, where you repeat the mantra at least a certain number of times. But because it's a positive vibration, it pulls your energy up. And when the mind is more energized, when sattva increases, then that brings all the benefits. And then eventually you can even go beyond the mind. And that is where it also becomes a potent preparation and even tool for meditation. So the japa itself is not the meditation, but it can definitely prepare you for it. And of course, when we talk about mantra specifically used in meditation, like you say, to transcend, these of course are very specific mantras. They are just the bijas, they're the seeds actually. So it is, like you said, it's you put it very beautifully, it doesn't really have a meaning in the sense that it's not a word, it's really a sound, it's a sound vibration, but it's very potent. And then that can take you beyond the mind to experience the consciousness. So you can transcend the mind. And as you said, that way japa is definitely one of the tools or the paths of yoga, even you can say. Because if we look at the yoga scriptures, the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, it's all about the mind and transcending the mind to be happy, to feel free, to burn many of your karmas. And also very beautifully, as it said, heyam dukkham anagatam, it can help you to prevent a lot of the suffering or misery even before it arises. And as in Ayurveda, we have this beautiful distinction between adija vyadi and anadija vyadi. They say, okay, you have the suffering that is physical, that is external or inflicted, where it's bumping your head or breaking a bone or being bitten by a dog or a snake or stung by a scorpion. I mean, the scriptures, they give nice examples. But that is just a very small part, maybe even less than 10%, of our misery or suffering in life. And when I learned about this little fun fact from Ayurveda, where they say most of our suffering or misery is born of the mind and the emotions. It's mental. And now mental health, of course, is a hot topic. But it made me realize that apart from the fact that, of course, the asanas and some of the other yoga techniques also take care of some of the physical discomforts, whether it is your back pain or other things. But more than that, it really addresses or attends to this more than 90% of mental and emotional suffering. Because this is true. Even I looked at my life and I say, yes, most of the time when I don't feel comfortable, when I'm not balanced or I don't feel good, it is not because of a physical pain in my leg or something. It's because mentally you may be stressed or you feel anxious or frustrated or uneasy. And yoga has different approaches. Of course, pranayama is also very effective. But japa is another beautiful way to settle the mind and to improve the quality of our thoughts. And that is also why, if we look from a Jyotish perspective, the Vedic astrology, it's one of the main remedies, because they say time has an impact. So the time also has a quality. And the way karma works is that it brings up certain feelings and thoughts in our consciousness, which then translate into our actions. And that is how we go through certain experiences. And we cannot consciously choose our thoughts. Thoughts come without asking you before. The same with feelings. You know, suddenly you feel a certain way in a certain situation or with a certain person. But that's why they said when we use mantra, then we can change the quality of the thoughts that come up. And that is how it can remedy some of your karmas. We may have to go through certain experiences, but definitely the impact can be reduced, and some can even be avoided. You know, some karmas can be burned, can be gotten rid of. And I find it so fascinating, because of course, even in Ayurveda, we talk about the Panchakosha, and many of the diseases or illness or imbalance in the body actually arises first on the more subtle layers. So it comes Absolutely. First in the mind, the consciousness, the thoughts, and when it's not addressed, then it comes down to the physical level, which now modern medicine also, of course, says many things are psychosomatic. Okay, you have health problems because you're too stressed, or there's too much anxiety, and that again affects your, you know, whether it's your hormonal balances or other aspects. But that is where mantra and these other techniques of yoga can really be beneficial, because it helps you to balance things on a subtle level, and then makes you more healthy and happy.
Yeah, beautiful. And you mentioned the mantra and the japa gives you that kind of ascension you were talking about, like raising the vibration. But I just want to slightly unpack it a bit more, in the sense that there are different mantras and different japa you can do to invoke different aspects of consciousness, right? Like you said about exactly. the Jyotish, the astrology, some for some planets, some for this. So it's not just like it's not just ascension and going up or down, but there's such a dynamic. What you can kind of, you can be prescribed, or you exactly. can choose perhaps, like, what aspect of consciousness do I want to invoke? Or like you beautifully said, what aspect of karma do I want to enhance my mind so that the karma will dissipate? So yeah, that's really nice. And like, I want to also explore this concept of siddhis, because siddhis is like divine human capabilities. And I see my guru, who are world-renowned Ayurvedic doctors, they have siddhis, okay, particularly in pulse diagnosis. They can do amazing things yeah. by feeling the pulse, not only diagnosing and healing. And I don't know all about them, because a lot of the things they do is secret, and they've grown up for generations. They start learning Ayurveda at 3 years old. But one of the, and what I'm learning because they're doing it to me, one of the key ways to develop this siddhi is through japa.
Yes.
And I love you to share that, because, yeah, in terms of developing.
So, yeah, so japa, like you said, it's very vast. The knowledge of mantras, it's a whole science. Just like in Ayurveda, there are so many aspects and so many layers. You can go from basics to, like you just gave a glimpse to the audience, to super advanced. In japa also, it is like that. There are certain mantras that are called prasiddha mantras, which anybody can chant. You can take up even without much of, you know, guidance or a specific initiation. And they will work for anybody. Like some of the maha mantras, like say Om Namah Shivaya. It's a mantra anybody can chant, you know, and there's no risk to it. It will give you results. It's like free Wi-Fi, you know, anybody can log in and it'll work. But then some mantras require initiation. So there it needs to be given in the proper manner by one who has the mantra siddhi, who has, you can say, in whom the mantra is alive. So then Beautiful. When they give it to you, it carries that energy already and it will work for you. There are procedures to, you can say, aliven a mantra, but these are very long and usually quite rigorous and really, to be honest, very difficult for a regular person living in today's world. It's not impossible, but it requires a lot of sadhana, a lot of practice under quite strict rules to finally result in that mantra becoming alive. But once it is, then someone like that can pass it on. So it's like if you have a candle and it's not lit and you don't have matches, then it may be a lot of effort. You have to find those stones that can produce a spark and maybe get some dry grass. And when you're lucky, finally, you'll get a fire. And then with that, you can light a candle. But once your candle is lit, if someone else comes to you with a candle that's not lit, it's much easier to light it.
This is really, really good point and really important, because even the tradition, my teacher, when he's been brought up, there are some cautions to be taken around mantra. And I guess, yeah, could you talk about that? If you do learn a mantra, or specifically maybe say it out loud, will bring more, invite more imbalances to maybe come when you're playing with or doing these sounds.
Yeah, so some mantras, like I said, need an initiation or something for them to work. And then, of course, like you said, each mantra has its own unique flavor. It invokes a certain energy or devata, a certain vibration in your consciousness. And if you're not really certain about that, or you don't understand it much, yeah, then it can be a gamble. You know, it's like you have so many potent herbs in Ayurveda, or even if someone doesn't know much about Ayurveda, in your own medicine locker at home, and they're all wonderful to cure specific diseases or fix imbalances. But if you randomly start popping pills, you know, like a certain herb may have great medicinal value, but if you take it when you don't need it, it's not going to do much, or it's not going to work for something completely different. And in some cases, it may even cause an imbalance, or it may even aggravate things. So in the case of mantra also, as with the other Vedic sciences, it's always recommended, or rather emphasized, that, you know, you learn this from a guru, from an acharya, from one who understands it. Learn it in the proper manner, because you would want to avoid, if you're intelligent, doing something that doesn't give you a result, or even worse, that gives you a different result, which may even be, you know, the opposite of what you want. And that way, I'm teaching a small workshop now in the Netherlands also for people, where we teach a few simple mantras that they could use if they may wish to in their daily life. And I was explaining to them that I taught them one mantra for Lakshmi, you know, the goddess of wealth and abundance. And I said, if you go on YouTube, for example, people may say, okay, what is the best mantra for wealth? And then you may find, oh, most powerful mantra for wealth, some Kubera mantra, and, you know, 5 million views. And just looking at it, you say, oh, this must really work, because so many people have listened to it. And it is some mantra for Kubera. But then if you see these devatas or these energies, at some point were also depicted. So after a long time, the rishis found that people started finding it difficult to connect with, or to understand what a divine vibration or energy is. It's difficult to relate to. So they said, okay, we'll make a symbolic depiction of the qualities of this energy. And if you see Lakshmi, for example, it's very pleasant, beautiful goddess sitting on a lotus, you know, it's, and usually they have something they ride on, you know, their vehicle, their vahana. So it could be an animal, or, but if you look at Kubera, for example, you know, Kubera technically is not a devata. It's a yaksha, which is a different type of energy. And if you see his depiction, his vehicle or what he rides on, for example, is a human being with a noose around his neck. So I left it at that, but I told people. So I said, no, so it's good to know a little bit, because it'll give you, at least without going into all the details of the symbolism, already you can see that definitely it's a different type of energy. And what is the kind of energy that you may want to invoke? And then we're not even yet talking about whether it's really effective or not for a person who has not been initiated or whatever. But, you know, there are different ways to get rich or to amass wealth. So it's also, what do you want? In the same way, when it comes to healing, as you know, there are different approaches. You know, you may be able to do a chemotherapy. It may work, but at the same time, it can be very destructive. So sometimes there may be a different path to healing that is much more compatible for your body or for where you're at. Same time, certain treatments can be prescribed in certain conditions, not in others. And it is a vast topic, but it's not something to be afraid of also. No? Many of these mantras, sometimes people also are worried about black magic, or someone is doing some bad mantras on me. But the interesting thing is that many of those mantras, unless someone has really been initiated and has done the proper sadhanas, they will hardly have any effect. You know, so someone being worried about, you know, their ex boyfriend or their mother-in-law doing some black magic on them, usually it hardly has any effect. Many times it will actually backfire on the person, because that's how these things work. And even if someone is that capable that he could actually do that, even then it will usually not happen, because once you're initiated to that extent, when you have so much of knowledge, then you know that doing such practices will give you such terrible karma that either in this birth or the next, you will suffer much more. You know? So even though there are some mantras in some of the scriptures that are given, for example, to, I don't know, to deter your enemies or to even paralyze them or to maybe even kill them, these were techniques that were used to protect the kings. You know, so it was used for the kingdom. And then the intention also is good. Just like a country may need an army, not because they want to kill people, but because you have to protect your people, you know. So there are a lot of misconceptions. Some people, I've come across also in India, they may be very worried sometimes, oh, you know, people are doing black magic, or many times it's actually more of an imbalance in the place where you say the Vastu is not so good, or you know, there may be other factors. Astrologically, the time may not be so good. So mantras is not something to be scared of. It's a beautiful knowledge. Mm. But like any proper science, to use it, we need to understand it correctly. It's, of course, same with Ayurveda.
Yeah, I love the analogy of just choosing any pill and popping it. I think our audience are familiar with mantra, so I would like to refine, and that's why I wanted to have this conversation, why I'm enjoying this topic, to refine people so that they don't get deviated so much and maybe cause some disturbances, and they can really get the maximum out of their mantra. So before I will ask you some more perhaps practical things around japa, I just want to share my very limited knowledge of what I've personally been taught about mantra by someone who is my guru, who is particularly cautious, you can say, compared to other yoga teachers who are like, yeah, Chan, you know, some people are more flexible than others, some teachers. And my things like always chanting inward is quote unquote safer, because you're more towards that field of transcendence. And if you're chanting out loud, there might be some mispronunciation, particularly me as a Westerner or someone who hasn't been brought up chanting this. So when you're creating it out loud, it may cause some imbalance, disturbance to the vibration, which can cause some disharmony. So one thing is to chant inward. And he once said to me also, if you're in a group, it's okay, like a kirtan or singing together, that can support. And yeah, that's just one thing I want to mention. He really likes to leave it to what we call pundits, those people who are brought up really chanting. He says, just let them do, that's better. And we actually did a wonderful podcast episode with a group of sisters called the Samadhi Collective. They're young women who have been brought up in India, and they've learned to chant. And I asked them to do a chant. I said, we started talking about Gayatri Mantra. And I said, can you chant that? He goes, actually, it's something we shouldn't be chanting out loud. So many things like this people don't know. And Gayatri Mantra, one of the most popular mantras, people love to chant.
Yes,
so.
But this is a challenge I also face, because I do often get this question. That, oh, you know, you've recorded some mantras we saw on Spotify, but can you also record Gayatri? And then I said, well, no, this is a Diksha mantra. It is given in initiation. And then you're not supposed to chant it out loud. So I said, I'm sorry, I will not be recording that one. But like you said, there are many people who have. But I guess in that way, even though I hail from the West, I probably subscribe to the approach like of your teacher, your acharya as well, your guru. Because, and I've seen the same with my master, you know. He's doing so much of work across the world to make people aware of these traditions. And we have beautiful kirtans, satsangs, you know. When people have problems, sometimes he'll say, okay, you chant Om Namah Shivaya mantra. But at the same time, he really follows the tradition. So for certain things, you know, people say, oh, can we chant this mantra, or can we do that? And then he say, no, you know, there's a proper way to do it. You need to learn, or, you know, let the pandits do that, like you said. I feel very fortunate that I've been allowed to learn quite a few of these things, so with the pundits, so that way I'm a bit of a pundit Beautiful. Myself now. Mm. But one thing that may be interesting to know also for your audience is I came across this in one of the scriptures, that for these mantras that you can anyway chant, you know, whether it's Om Namah Shivaya or whatever mantras people may be chanting. So this doesn't go for those that you're not supposed to chant out loud, but for the other ones, they said you can also use japa as a way to balance the gunas. They said when the sattva is predominant, when you're balanced, that is when you chant mentally, because that is most effective. Because even you can be chanting out loud and doing the dishes or planning your day, it need not necessarily mean your mind is and your consciousness is fully invested in that, which makes it less effective. But when you chant mentally, your whole mind has to be there, so your consciousness is fully involved. So it is much more effective as a mantra practice. They say it is, you know, at least 100 times as effective as doing it out loud. But to do that effectively, the mind needs to be balanced. The sattva needs to be predominant. Because when rajoguna, rajas is predominant, there is restlessness, there will be all kinds of thoughts coming up. So it keeps getting broken. And if tamoguna is predominant, that tamas is more, then you may go off to sleep. Because then the moment the mind expands a little, you doze off. But that may not always be the case. You may not always be in sattva mode. So then they say, then what to do? When rajoguna is predominant, they recommend that you chant it, you can say whispering. It's called upamshu, where your tongues, your lips are moving, but it's a very soft sound, almost no sound. And they say chanting the mantra like that will bring the rajas down. So then you can use it, and then the moment it is settled sufficiently, then you can chant mentally, of course. And when your tamoguna is predominant, when tamas is more, then they said you chant it out loud, because then that will energize your system. It'll take you out of tamas. So that way, also there are different ways to use japa. Of course, you have to see the mantras used, but it may be nice for people to know, because sometimes you may sit to do your japa, but you keep dozing off. So then this is something you could experiment with.
Ah, so beautiful. And it's just a testament to the dynamics that there's no one prescription. And really enjoy that. So one thing that the listeners are probably familiar with, and those who still haven't got a picture of japa, think about the Hare Krishnas you see in the street or wherever you see them, with their bag hanging around their neck and their hand in the bag. They're doing japa. They're moving the beads, and they're using a bead, usually 108 beads, necklace kind of thing to chant. So I just want to go into a bit more refined, practical things. I've been taught, and different people teach, to not wear shoes. Wear shoes. You see Hare Krishnas walking the streets with their shoes, chanting. And again, different applications. You may be doing a certain japa, which requires a bit more conscious awareness of purity compared to maybe a more casual one, for lack of a better word. So yeah, I just want to touch in a few of these things, like shoes and washing before, state of all that kind of little practical things, if we could briefly touch, just so people can. Because I know a lot of people these days, as Jyotish is becoming popular, as you said, one of the most popular remedies is japa. And I see patients come into my clinic who have told me about their new japa that they've been prescribed, and they're doing this program for 41 days of chanting to mitigate some karma from a planet or from their relationship, whatever it is. But they're not aware of this. And I just want to share this so that they can be more protected from these powerful vibrations, as well as enhance their progress and evolution.
Yeah. So, like you said, different traditions may differ slightly in what and how they teach it. But as some basic principles, with any sadhana, you know, I would recommend, even whether it's your meditation or your japa, to, where possible, have a place where you may not be disturbed much. You can do it with full attention. And that aspect of purity is also important. You know, even in the yoga scriptures, this is one of the important niyamas, no? That you take care of your purity, because again, sattva, no? If it's not clean, many people may have experienced, you've been out all day, you're a little bit sticky, you don't change your clothes and you just sit to meditate. It's very different than if you take a bath, wear clean clothes, and then sit and meditate. It's not just the physical thing. Your state of mind is different. The same is in your house or in your office or your bedroom. If it is clean, tidy, it's very different and it's all cluttered and messy and dirty. Shoes also, of course, it's something you walk around with, especially in the older days also. You know, it's not so clean necessarily outside. But then if you're saying, yes, just walking on the street, doing your japa, I don't want to comment on any other tradition. But personally, if you ask me that, okay, how should I do my japa? Or should is a strong word, but what would be a nice way to do it? Then I would always suggest that, you know, sit quietly, peacefully, and just focus on that. Because like I said, it can become a mechanical thing. Of course, you can keep doing. I can keep chanting a mantra out loud also while I'm doing the dishes, cooking the food, all. But then your mind is not fully there. You know? And I think it's very important to remember that with any spiritual practice, I would always say quality over quantity. Where, of course, being regular is important, but we should not underestimate the importance of having that right frame of mind and awareness. You know, even for pujas in the temples and all, there is a beautiful shloka that says, Archakasya cha bhavena shila bhavati shankara, which means that it is the attitude and the feeling of the one who worships that makes that stone turn into a shivalinga or to make the devata be present there. If it's just mechanical worship, you do all the mantras, you do all the procedures, but it's not from the heart, that feeling is not there, then it says, then it's just a stone, you know? That is not God, or that is not divinity. So the feeling is of utmost importance. And the same is with any of these practices. Of course, you may not always have that feeling of sincerity and devotion and that's why discipline is important, where you say, even if I don't feel like, let me sit and do it for some time. But if you're doing so many other things and then in between you're chanting your japa, then that doesn't really count, I would say, to your merit or reducing your karmas. So there's always this tricky thing, no, where the ritualistic aspect, if that takes predominance, then you can keep breaking coconuts all day. You can keep doing abhishek. But how much is going to change in your life? Well, you can tell me, but it's limited. However, yes, that's why it's always recommend, even if you cannot take a full bath before you sit, it's good at least wash your feet, your hands, you know, wash your mouth once. So it's like basic cleanliness. And again, and that you can probably explain even better, but Ayurvedically also, it has a purpose. You know, you wash your feet. We talk about the pancha prana. You know, it has an effect on the body. So it's all being intelligent also. How do you prepare yourself in such a way that you have the most output, you get the best result? And then for japa, yes, there are some nuances. Like they carry the bag, like you said, they have their japa mala in a bag, because traditionally it is said that it's good that the japa is done in a way that it's not visible to others. And then you can say, oh, but I'm sitting at home, you know, nobody's watching. Yeah, well, there's always someone watching. But it's also, the, you know, it's understanding the idea behind it. Because one of the things is that, one, it's a personal practice. You know, it's not for showing off. So it's not that you want to show people, see how much of japa I'm doing. At the same time, even maybe you're not so concerned about, you know, showing off, but then if other people see it, you may still think, oh, what will they think about it? Or so it's a personal practice. You know? The same way the mala, we keep it clean. So a japa mala is usually kept separately. It's not worn during the day. Or because sometimes also I see people, like, with all good intention, you know, they buy it and they see people wearing a Rudraksha mala. So they wear it also, and in between they use it for japa. But they say, no, you use it for the japa. So to keep that energy pure, it's kept separately. So you keep it in a small bag or something and you just take it out when you need it. And for each mala, there again, there are qualities. I don't think we need to get into that much detail now.
All the different materials, yes, used and things, yeah. And thing to note that usually it's kept separate, mala, to what you wear on your body, to what you use for japa. And the bag, is it almost like containing that energy and not allowing external influences, we call drishti dosha, so like the doshas from other energies around the local environment to
so impact? It need not be a bag. You can also cover it with a cloth or the pandis, they usually have their shalya, the angavastra. The bag is makes it easy, because one thing they also prescribe traditionally is that, for example, that it shouldn't hang below the navel. So you keep it somewhere near the heart, but then sometimes the mala can be a little bit longer, or the person can be a little shorter. So then if you put it in the bag, anyway, it will not go lower. It's protected, so it won't become dirty. Because again, you know, these are practical things. Even if you're sitting on the floor and the mala is longer, it may touch the floor. It may touch something that is not clean. So they say, no, that's why we keep it above the navel. So the bag makes it easy. It's practical. And because traditionally, usually they don't use the index finger in the process of counting. So then to avoid it touching the mala, or to make it easy to not involve it in holding the japa mala and the counting, with a bag, sometimes I've even seen people, they'll keep the finger outside. You know? So it's like, and again, it's not because it's a bad finger, but the idea also is because that's the finger that is used to point out the other, or to point out mistakes. So they say the guru uses it, but we, as a student, it's not your place to point out mistakes. So it's just, again, that little bit of, you know, this practice takes you beyond the duality. So once you understand the principle behind it, then it becomes a beautiful reminder rather than a strange practice that is forced on you.
Yeah. And this is the point of the conversation, is to refine and introduce these subtle tweaks to your practice, if you're doing this already, to enhance it. And it is subtle, but it's powerful. You know, every finger is correlated with a different Mahabhuta, different element, and different. So that's why all these things, we don't have to analyze it. If you have a good guru, you want to listen to what Swamiji is saying, I recommend it. Give it a go. Just a couple more things on japa before we finish. You mentioned quality versus quantity. Now, of course, in most things, especially with Vedic tradition and yoga and all this, quality, of course. And I guess if quality is an established thing, of course, for some people, it's like, that's primary. Of course, I have to give quality. I'm not just going to do this as a mechanical. But there is something, at least what I've learned in japa, and I've only, just for reference, I've only learned japa from one teacher, and it's all about Ayurveda. It's when I get initiated into my what's called Dhanvantari Dikshas, my Ayurvedic initiations, it's just certain japa for Ayurveda. And there is something that he's emphasized about quantity.
Yes.
I guess assuming that quality is there, and that's there, of course, that's the foundation. But it is like, you have 41 days, you want to reach this number. So, and that contributes to these cities, is the quantity.
Yes.
So I'd love you to just touch on that.
Yes. No, you've beautifully brought that up. And yes, especially when we talk about getting very specific results, definitely quantity matters. And this is also, again, where that the knowledge of an understanding of the dimension of time within consciousness. Because they say that, you know, 41 days or 48 days, some scriptures differ, but it's considered as a mandala. And a mandala means that it's one circle, you can say, becomes round. And of course, it can differ per mantra. If you really go into Jyotish, then some people can prescribe you really detailed prescriptions for some specific purpose. But it is said, when you do something for this number of days, say you do it for 41 or 48 days, that one mandala, then that completes something. So even if you want to start something new, they say you do it for this many days consecutively without a gap, it becomes a habit. And if you do it for 3 mandalas, they say it becomes your nature, for example. This is for general stuff. So for mantras also, there are these classifications that for a certain mantra, it may require a certain number of japa every day, for a certain number of days, for it to reach a certain stage of completion. And there can be different stages to that. But for example, there is the concept of Puras Charan, which means that for each akshara of the mantra, each syllable or each letter, you need to do 100,000 repetitions of that mantra. So the Panchakshari, Namah Shivaya, for this mantra, for example, the Puras Charan would be 500,000 because it has Namah Shivaya, five letters. So that way, having done that mantra 500,000 times in the proper manner would give the mantra siddhi or the Puras Charan for that. For Gayatri, because it's 24 syllables, it's a lot. It's 2.4 million times. But in the same way, like you said, for sadhanas, and it's beautiful that you are learning in a tradition that, well, for lack of a better word, that is so proper, because of course it's an essential part. You know, any of these Vedic knowledges, it's a parampara, it's an ancient tradition, a lineage, and connecting to that through these practices will also give you the, to some extent, the knowledge and blessings of that whole lineage. We can only do so much ourselves. So we can use all the extra help. But so there will be specific things. Like you said, your guru will tell you that, okay, this mantra you need to do this many days and this many times every day. And that will give you the foundation that is required to be able to, you know, even to digest certain knowledge or to have a certain experience. You know, I know from
Absolutely.
From my master once, he was teaching us some advanced meditation practices, you know, also with this the sutras. And some people were not getting much of an experience, while others had amazing experience, crazy stuff. So then he was guiding some of the people and individually, and he was saying that, for example, okay, you know, right now your system has too much of ama and too much of toxins and impurities. There is too much of an imbalance, and it will not allow you to really go deep in meditation. So we need to take care of that first. So I said, okay, you do, you know, do a virechana or shankaprakshalana, or first you need to clean your system. And then after that, when those basic foundation is more proper, then you see, oh, people start getting different experience. And the same way for certain practices, you need to have a certain foundation. I know even for Jyotish, you know, for people to, when they want to learn properly, there are certain sadhanas you need to do just to prepare your consciousness to grasp the knowledge and digest it in a way that you can start using it intuitively in the right manner. Or if you are guiding people, you're seeing their charge, or then in some way you're changing their karmas because you're telling them, okay, you can do this and this and this, and it will take care of those karmas. So you need to also do something to, again, clear yourself from those impressions so that you don't accumulate any karmas. So nowadays, like you said, people are very enthusiastic. Even Jyotish is becoming very popular, but I see many people who've just done, you know, a half year course somewhere or read a few books, and they start consulting and guiding people. But karmically, this is not really smart or recommended, because as you know, even as a Vaidya, when you do the Nadi Pariksha or any other, but especially Nadi Pariksha, and especially the really good ones, there are so many things that you will see. And out of that, there are many things that you will maybe never tell a person, because you have been given that blessing or the siddhi to see that, but that doesn't mean you need to or even can share that with people, because consciousness is very powerful. So even a normal doctor, if they tell someone that, oh, you know, it's very bad, probably you're going to die, then that thought itself can disturb a person to such an extent that it will be very difficult for them to maybe recover fully. So
Absolutely.
A doctor, even if there's a 5% chance they will live, they say, okay, no, yeah, okay, you do these things and, you know, it can really help you. So, and I've had one experience like that once with a very good Vaidya. We had someone visiting our ashram in Bangalore from Tamil Nadu, from the Siddha traditions. And he did a Nadi Pariksha for me, and he was telling me that there are different nadis. One is the Prakriti Nadi, but there are other nadis also. But then when I asked him about it, he said, no, there is a Guru Nadi, there is a Daiva Nadi. And I had never heard of this. And I said, wow. And then I asked him about it, but he wouldn't tell me much. And then I asked one of our very senior Vaidyas that, you know, I heard about this thing, but I Googled and I couldn't find much. So, and nowadays you can find quite a lot on Google. So I asked, can you tell me more about this? And then she looked at me with this, you know, this look, inquisitive look, and like trying to scan, like, what is this boy been up to? And then she only told me, she said, I'm really surprised that he mentioned that, because we see so many things, but normally we don't talk about it. Of course, even he hadn't said much about it. So I'm still in the dark when it comes to some of those things, which is fine. But it does make it very magical, you know, when it's, there is this amazing world. And that's why I feel that it reminds me a little bit of these, you know, this Harry Potter kind of world where there is so much of knowledge. And I feel we are so, so fortunate that even in today's world, even if not everything, but some of them, this has been preserved, that we have access to it today. And imagine, you know, we have podcasts like yours that are sharing this with people. So they get to find out, they can benefit from it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's important to not reveal or not speak out loud, because it preserves that Shakti, and we want to keep some certain knowledge in the field of the subtle and not at so relative manifest, so that it operates at the power it does, because the power is in the subtle. Okay. I have one last question on japa, and that is 108. The beads on a mala, it's kind of completes one round of japa. We've also had a few people ask, why 108?
So 108 in the Vedic cosmology or tradition is also a number that completes, that represents fullness or completion. And there are many references as to all the things that you can count as 108. So one is that, for example, from a Jyotish perspective, they say we consider 9 celestial bodies, the Navagraha, and they move through 12 Rashis or constellations. So 9 planets moving through 12 constellations will give you 108 different qualities of time or impacts of time. So then they say you chant one mantra for each of those and you've covered all your bases. But that is just one example. Another thing, some people may not be aware, but it's quite interesting, that the distance from the sun to the earth is 108 times the diameter of the sun. The distance of the moon to the earth is 108 times the diameter of the moon. And I think it was the sun also, the sun's diameter is 108 times the diameter of the earth. So there are many, many places. If you go deeper into this, people can Google also, you will find all kinds of beautiful Vedic mathematical equations of how this number has all kinds of significations. But the idea in the context of mantra japa is that when you complete 108, it's one round. It's complete, you can say. And that is why, actually the malas have 109 beads usually. It's 108 plus one. And that one is called the Guru or the Sakshi or the Meru. There's different names for it. And that is just to indicate that you've completed your round. So if people want to do it really properly, then when they do the japa, so you start after that and you go around all the way. And then if you want to do more, because sometimes you may want to do more than one round, then traditionally we don't cross that extra one. They say you don't cross the Guru or the Sakshi. You can turn, flip the mala around, and then again, when you continue, it's like you go back. So that one is not crossed.
That's interesting. I've heard you say that. I've never heard that before. Can you explain why? And I don't have, I don't know if I have a 108 or 109, but I have a tussle sticking out.
So usually with that also, there's one extra one. I mean, you can count once. But that one indicates that is the special one.
Yeah.
And then...
But why the flipping around?
So the thing is that there are different stories, even in the Puranas. For example, they say that one of the reasons why they call it Meru is they say that bead is the Meru, where all the devatas are meditating or Shiva is meditating. So then you don't want to disturb them. But right. I think one of the main concepts is that one, of course, it indicates that you're complete. So if something doesn't stick out, you may not realize, because usually your eyes are closed. It's a very meditative process. No? It's, you tend to transcend a little in between. So it's without having to worry, you will know, okay, I'm done. And I think turning it around is also, that little bit of awareness. Because otherwise you can just keep going, but you consciously, okay, yes, I'm going to do another. Maybe, nice. And that I'm not sure, because I've not personally really explored this. I've learned it that way, and I respect that, so I follow it, and I teach the same. I can imagine that probably even energetically there must be a reason for it. But that,
it's kind of like stepping over someone's legs. You know how they say, if your legs are out, walk over people's legs. That's superstitious. That
kind of
thing.
There may be more reasons. My knowledge is also limited, so there must be many more things. But it may be nice for people to know.
Mm. Okay, Swamiji, I'm in a similar position to you, but much less evolved. But I want to ask, as a white man who is teaching so predominantly in India, teaching the Vedas, how does that feel? Because me, I've had a little exposure. I've started lecturing in Mumbai about Ayurveda. And when I'm lecturing Ayurveda to people in India who know less about Ayurveda than my lectures in Australia, it is just, it's a great honor. And I feel like I'm honoring the tradition. But I would love to hear you, who's doing it on a big scale, beautiful thing. How does it feel for you?
Well, honestly, I feel very fortunate, very blessed. I remember it was a bit of a, I'll not say struggle, but I had to be very determined when I wanted to start this journey, that when I came to India and I had asked my master about being initiated into the Gayatri Mantra, the Upanayana Sanskara, where you get the sacred thread, because that is a prerequisite to chant the Vedic mantras and to learn some of these things. I had his blessings, but then it was a new thing. So it was not something that had happened there before for people coming from outside India. Even within India, it was limited. But then when that happened, I had not really learned Hindi yet. I knew a decent bit of Sanskrit, but Hindi I had not yet learned. So, and the local languages there, also Kannada, and I did speak Tamil also. I didn't speak that. So it was a bit, initially to get started was quite challenging. But then a few years down the line, I remember finding myself sitting there in our ashram with a batch of new people that from India that had been initiated, gone through the Upanayana Sanskara, where I was presiding over that. And then I would be teaching them how to pronounce the mantras, how to perform their Sandhya Vandana, the little ritual they do every day. And I was explaining the meaning of the mantras, teaching them the correct intonation, pronunciation. And I felt very humbled that my master gave had that much of trust in me, that you are capable to teach this, at the same time because it's something that's very close to my heart. That's maybe why I was so passionate also to learn about these things, that I still have a very big thirst for this knowledge. I keep learning new things, and it's infinite, of course, but it's so rich, and I feel it's really very fulfilling to share it. So I'm involved in many activities, including some projects and other things. But whenever I'm teaching these things, it really feels like my dharma. Inside, something in me becomes really happy when I'm teaching someone some mantras, or I'm teaching them about any of these Vedic sciences, or whether it's Upanishads or something about Jyotish or Ayurveda or whatever it may be. And in India, yes, it's interesting, because at the same time, even though it hails from India, and it's been preserved there all these years, as you also would have seen, to a great extent, there's also a decline in the sense that many people stop following many of their ancient practices. So in villages still, maybe without knowing so, people were following many practices, and a dinacharya and all that is very conducive. That is as per Ayurveda. But as people move away from the villages into the cities, they become more globalized, lifestyles change. A lot of that is getting lost or disappearing. And that's why it's important that people rediscover not just that it is there, but also why we do it. Because I've seen many young people also, it's not that they're not interested, but they want to know why. And many times, because it's been passed down for so many generations, people may not know or have forgotten. Like they would ask their parents or grandparents, okay, why do we offer coconut? Or why should I do puja? Why should I chant mantra? Why should I go to the temple? Or why should I follow this practice when I'm eating? Or, and they also don't know this. No, but this is what our parents used to tell us. And they used to follow it. But now people are not always ready to just follow it. You know? But then when someone comes and explains, then they say, oh, yes, but this makes a lot of sense. No, this is very beautiful. Okay, let me do this. And I feel grateful that something, you know, a tradition that has already given me so much, it feels like a small thing that I can give back to spread it, to make people aware, you know, to pass it on, whatever little I have learned and understood. And also sometimes I've seen that coming from the West, sometimes people are more receptive or they take it more seriously, which is another discussion, whether that is a good thing or a bad thing or whether it is unfortunate or, but it's the reality. You know, there are some people still that look to the West because they feel it's more developed or for whatever reason. And that is why they say, oh, you know, yes, this is something, you know, they may be more interested to learn or they take it more seriously. Just like in earlier days, maybe a yoga teacher coming from India in the West was valued more because they really know. Now, of course, it's the scenario has changed. But, you know, like that, people may feel, oh, you know, this guy from my village or my neighbor is telling me, what does he know? But someone who has come all the way from the West or from another part of the world, oh, then it must be really something. But
it's such an exciting phenomenon that's currently unfolding, this younger generation of Indians having this spark of the Vedic knowledge with that more understanding the essence. And I think that's a wonderful thing that the Art of Living organization is doing, because it's just, I don't know the statistics or whatever, but I'm pretty sure it's like one of the biggest movements in the world right now. Like it's
I think massive. So. Yeah. I also don't know all the statistics,
And a lot of it is India and Indians, and it's just they're getting this re-spark. It's wonderful, and people like you and so many other teachers within organization and similar organizations. It's really wonderful. So, thanks for being part of that. We've got another podcast for those listening with Philip Goldberg, who's done extensive research on the influence of Veda in the West, and now it's kind of unfolding towards the opposite. But yeah. Okay, and the last question is, I guess, on everyone's mind, and I didn't have it written down or anything, but now it's got to be there. It's like, how can I start doing japa? I want to do this practice. Where? How can I approach it?
Yeah, so that's a bit tricky, of course. But like I said, there are certain things that are fine for everybody. So, for example, a mantra like Om Namah Shivaya or Om Namo Narayanaya is something that anybody can chant. And I think I still have a free ebook on my website also. People go to swamipurnachaitanya.com that is about mantras. So you'll find a few other mantras also with a little bit of an explanation, a few basic tips, you know, how you can chant it. That may be a nice place to start. If you would like, if you want to go deeper, then yes, I strongly recommend to find someone who is well-versed in this. You know, that doesn't mean your practice has to be very complicated. But it just means someone can guide you in the right manner. The same is with astrology. You know, there are so many astrologers, but not all of them are really part of a tradition. So they may not always have the extensive knowledge that I would recommend before recommending any mantra or chanting something. And at the same time, like I said, I don't recommend just Googling or going on YouTube, best mantra for this or that, or there are all kinds of things out there which need not necessarily be recommended. So don't think that it has to be complicated to be more effective. No. There is a reason why some of these mantras were called Maha mantras, the great mantras, not just because they work for everybody, but they also have a very harmonious effect. You know, it helps us in so many aspects of our life. In the same way, there are certain mantras that have a lot of benefits, but you need not chant them. Like, for example, like you said, no, certain mantras, we leave it to the pandits. So I recorded one CD with suktas, different Vedic hymns for different purposes. And you can listen to it and meditate with it. The same way you can listen to Rudram, which is a very powerful Vedic mantra. That doesn't mean you have to chant it yourself. You can listen to it, close your eyes. It'll take you to a meditative space and it will have a very beneficial impact. So that is also something how we can make mantras a part of our life.
Yeah, thank you, Swamiji. I mean, this top, we could talk for hours and days and weeks on these mantras, because mantra for this, mantra for that, listening to mantra, chanting yourself. So I think we'll leave it at that. We've whet the appetite of everyone. And yeah, I really, really appreciate you coming on the show, Swamiji. As you mentioned your website, and also Swamiji shares beautiful short videos on Instagram, which I really enjoy. And Swami Purna Chaitanya, you can see. And anything else you want to mention, or any other directions of where people can find out more about your teachings? And
I mean, my website has all the links. If they go to swamipurnacharanya.com, it has like YouTube and all of these. There's some nice stories maybe for people who are keen also from some of the scriptures about some of the saints and sages, the rishis.
Mm-hmm.
I've shared during the lockdown. So there are stories about, for example, the life of Adi Shankaracharya, some of the great sages like Brahmananda Saraswati, or the different gurus of Dattatreya. And all these things are there, as well as some stories from the Puranas that may be interesting for people.
Absolutely, I'm very interested.
And for those who want to explore maybe meditation a little bit more, I wrote a book during lockdown that was published in India by Penguin, became a bestseller there. Now it's been translated in about 10 languages. I never expected, but the feedback has been really good. So just to understand how the mind works a little more, how to manage it, and it has some practical exercises and also a lot of the insights that I've learned from my master over the last 20 years of my meditation practice. So it's very accessible, but even people who have been meditating for some time, it apparently still often adds a lot of value. So there's a chapter on the difference between mindfulness and meditation, for example, and some practical do's and don'ts, some tips and tricks that may enhance your meditation practice. Check it out. It's available in Australia and all over the world. So it's called Looking Inward.
Okay. Beautiful. And the stories, where can I'm so excited.
On YouTube.
Is that you? Video? So it's you talking. Yes, great.
Yeah, it's me talking. The background is a little boring, but the stories are very, very nice.
It's always beautiful to listen to stories, Puranic stories. Yes.
I wish you all the best, Dylan. You're doing such a wonderful job in sharing this knowledge. I enjoyed some of your videos on Instagram as well.
Thank you.
And it's a real blessing, especially in these times. And I truly wish you all the very best, and that you may keep reaching more people and inspire more people to explore this beautiful ancient wisdom of Ayurveda, of the Vedic knowledge, and that it may help many more.
Thank you. Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev.
Awesome man, Swami Purna Chaitanya. Isn't he great? Remember to check out swamipurnachaitanya.com. Leave a review on iTunes and let us know what you think. Tell me what you think. Take a screenshot of this and share. Share what some of your takeaways, and tag Vital Vedas, tag Swami Purna Chaitanya. We'd love to hear what you get from this, and check out the rest of the episodes more on this beautiful thing. As I said earlier in the episode number 83, Hollywood to the Himalayas, Deeper Connections and Euphoric Love with Sadhviji Bhagavati Saraswati, another Westerner who's moved from the West to India and has taken this path of renunciation in order to support the society and the greater good. And we go into her story again, which is interesting. And another great bhakta, another great devotee to her guru in Rishikesh, northern India. So yeah, another similar episode is with the Samadhi Collective of the Vital Veda podcast, with similarly two girls from the UK, sisters who were brought up in India. And they were brought up in gurukuls. They were brought up with Sanskrit teachers and learning chantings. And they can chant, like, it takes you to a whole level. And they gracefully were blessed for them to chant in the podcast episode with them. So that's with Kamala and Janavi, the Samadhi Collective, and with similar topic on the mantra. So you can hear from their point of view. So check out, there's a lot of good stuff on the Vital Veda podcast. We're nearly around 100 episodes. There's a lot. All right, my dear friend, thanks for joining. Till next time, much love. If you want to go deeper into things like this, check out Swamiji's thing. If you want to go deeper into health consultations and optimizing your health, and what we do at Vital Veda, and what I do when I consult people, my patients, my clients, is I make you self-sufficient in balancing your own physiology. So if there's something within you that you want to address in your health, maybe there's nothing, you just want to optimize your health and prevent. But these days, there's a lot of toxins that we're living in and the disease is definitely there. So in order to mitigate that at the root level and allow wellness to permeate, book a consultation online at vitalvader.com.au. I would love to work closely with you. And as I said, empowering you into being self-sufficient in balancing your own physiology. So look forward to that. If you feel that calling and you feel that step for your own physical health, as well as, of course, mental, spiritual. So until next time, see you on the Vital Vader podcast. Much love.